Well, good afternoon and welcome to Kicker Radio, our weekly radio show produced here at College of the North Atlantic entirely by journalism students. My name is Martin Jones.
And my name is Emily Liver, and we will be your hosts for the next 90 minutes. Martin, tell our listeners what they can expect in today's show.
Thanks, Emily. Today is a special edition of Kicker Radio. We're extending our show to 90 minutes, and we're devoting the entire show to discuss the issues of racism here in the province.
We have a great lineup of guests and panel discussions as we have an open and frank discussion about racism here in Newfoundland. In the first half an hour, we have Patty Daly from VOCM Open Line and Ashley Fitzpatrick from The Telegram.
In the second half hour, we're going to sit down with Justin Campbell from the Association of New Canadians.
And then we will close the show with Father Paul Lundrigan and Haseen Khan from the Muslim Association of Newfoundland and Labrador. But before we get to all that, here's Erica Yetman with today's news.
Thanks for that, Emily. A new report released yesterday by CRA as a part of their Atlantic Quarterly telephone survey shows that two-thirds of Atlantic Canadians support potential immigrants being screened for Canadian values. The results are consistent across Atlantic Canada, with 68% of residents being completely or mostly supportive of increased screening. Our hosts, Martin Jones and Emily Liver, are going to discuss the survey results more in depth coming up in the first half hour. In other news, Kicker Radio is talking about racism this week. Racism can ruin a child's life, but not at Holy Hearts High School. The school community comes together to support one another and rise above racism together. Kicker's Josh White tells us more.
Holy Heart High School in St. John's is rising above racism. The school has a tradition of welcoming students from all around the world. Principal Sheldon Berry says that this makes the school a better place.
It certainly gives the school a very clear perspective on the world. We're not just a small collection of individuals. We're now represented by people with different viewpoints, different religions, different philosophies of education from over 60 countries.
Berry adds that everyone, no matter who they are, is welcome.
It's a culture within the school that any student that comes here is part of the school, no matter where they're from.
Debbie House is the assistant principal with Holy Heart. She says that these students can bring something special to the classroom and can be themselves when they come to school.
The richness of their heritage and culture and their perspective often on being new citizens to Newfoundland and to our country. So there's a richness of their language and the celebrations they have and the festivals and all of those things. And, you know, it just brings a richness to our whole building. Students, whether they're international students or other nationalities or our own kids, can come in and just be whoever they want to be. They can dress however they want to dress. They can act however they want to act. And people don't mind. You can be very individualistic here in the building.
While racism is not going away, Holy Heart High School has found a way to overcome this and make the school a much better place. For Kicker Radio, I'm Josh White.
For the past few weeks, Kicker has been working on a continual series about rural Newfoundland. The series details the struggles and issues throughout outports throughout the island. In our latest story, Kicker's Kyle Greenham spoke with the photographer behind the popular Facebook page, Last Newfoundland.
Rotting houses with no one to care for them or even tear them down. It's a common sight all over Newfoundland. A bleak look into a way of life that is fading away. St. John's photographer Steve Campbell has created the Facebook page Lost Newfoundland to document this very phenomenon.
I've got pictures of old pickup trucks, old machinery, you know, all sorts of old things, like, you know, things from the past in Newfoundland, so to speak, that I figured people would think was interesting. But, I mean, I mostly went to the houses, and that, geez, seems like I'm not the only one who likes that sort of thing, right? Some of them, you know, really work out really well from just a photography perspective. You know, you got an old house in a bleak landscape, you know, you can work with that, you know?
Taking his camera to communities across the Avalon, Campbell finds torn and mangled sheds, cars, and homes. While no one knows how long these houses will stand, Campbell preserves them digitally.
The houses have a story, and you wonder what it is, who lived there, what happened, and how did, you know, one house, same-sized style house, is still sitting there with someone living in it, and another similar house, a couple of doors up, has just been sitting there empty for 20, 30, 40 years, you know. And, I mean, when I put those photos on Flickr, they would never have any information. I put them on Lost Newfoundland now. Somebody has the information and the history of the house for me almost immediately. Now I've actually gotten the stories behind the houses. In a lot of cases, people have even sent me old pictures, pictures of the house when somebody was living in it years ago.
One of Campbell's most popular works was on the abandoned amusement park in Trinity Loop. The images are haunting. A rusting Ferris wheel, a damaged dining car, a piano that hasn't been played in a decade. He hopes to soon travel out to western Newfoundland to garner more photos for the series.
There's lots of parts of the island I'm planning to go to, but you need a few weeks off and you need to plan around a big trip around it to get out to the west coast or, you know, which is where I like to go. So hopefully this summer I'll be able to find a few more places before they're all gone.
Lost Newfoundland currently has over 13,000 likes on Facebook and is updated with new images weekly.
Mostly it was either fishermen's homes or people that lived a more traditional way of life. And I guess with the declining populations in the outports, the collapse of the fishery, a lot of people just don't want to live there anymore. It's a different way of life that's pretty much gone now. I mean, based around the fishery, based around a more simple lifestyle. And I think that, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of that. And these houses are just a glimpse back to the past.
Kyle Grenham, Kicker Radio.
If you liked what you heard today, you can find more stories done by our Kicker team on our website, kicker.cna-nl.com. Back to you, Martin.
Well, thanks, Erica. Up next, we have the latest in weather and traffic with our very own Kyle Grenham.
Thanks, Martin. I'll start with traffic here today. So there's a collision just recently at Topsail Road and Cohen Ave, and it's slowing traffic in every direction, so be careful if you're going down Topsail. There's some potholes all over town. There's some really bad ones on Ruth Avenue and Pitts West. There's another bad pothole coming off the Team Gushu ramp on the outer ring going west. So watch out for those potholes. I know there's some around Stefanger where I'm from as well. And we're still seeing some effects from the storm. There are traffic lights still being repaired. They were repairing lights earlier on Prince Philip and Thorburn. And on Topsail Road from Brookfield to Dunn, there's no power until 10 tonight. So you will see some four-way stops there at the traffic lights. But on good news, the snow is clearing, and people can see around corners now. So I'm sure the drivers are happy about that. And in terms of weather, we got a mix of sun and cloud here. And there's a 40% chance of flurries tonight. And it looks like it's going to be a low of minus 2. And winds gushing to 30 to 50. So it won't be too bad of an evening. And tomorrow morning, there's a 40% chance of flurries again, winds gusting 20 to 40 kilometers, and a high of plus 1. Back to you guys.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. We'll hear again from you in the next half an hour. But now we've got Josh with the latest sports news. Hey, Josh.
How's it going, guys?
Pretty good. How are you?
Oh, doing pretty good. It was a pretty busy night in the world of NHL last night. It was the Boston Bruins versus the Calgary Flames, and Boston actually beat Calgary 5-2, and that ended a franchise winning streak for Calgary at 10 games. It was also Philadelphia versus Pittsburgh, and that was 4-0 for Philly. Colorado versus Detroit, that was a 3-1 score. And Anaheim versus St. Louis is 2-1. In the world of NBA, there's some notable scores here. Boston versus Minnesota, 117-104 for Boston as they move up the Eastern Conference standings. So it is a pretty busy night in the world of sports tonight as the playoff race gets a little bit closer. And speaking of the playoffs, in hour two, I will be talking about the NHL playoffs and how the playoff race is getting even more tighter and tighter as we speak. Back to you guys.
All right, thanks, Josh. We're going to take a brief musical break here. It's our excuse to bring our first guests into the studio. We have CNA music student Kelly Loader and a song called Changes.
We'll be hearing more music from Kelly throughout our show. Now it's time for our first panel discussion in the studio today. We have Patty Daly from VOCM's Open Line and Ashley Fitzpatrick from The Telegram. Welcome, you guys, and thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we devoted the entire show today to speaking about racism here in the province. Yesterday, the CRA released a report showing that 68% of Atlantic Canadians polled either completely or mostly supported screening for Canadian values. Now, the report went on to say they didn't really specify what Canadian values were. So my first question for you guys is, what exactly are Canadian values?
Huh. Well, it's a really interesting question. I think if you asked 100 people, you would get 100 different answers. And I think that might also play into when you get a poll like the one you saw yesterday as to what's coming out of it. You know, if everybody has a bit of a different idea, the response can have totally different meanings person to person. So I don't know how much faith I put in a poll like that. But for me, Canadian values, I wouldn't even venture to define it, to be honest with you. I think if nothing else, this country is defined by its openness and its ability to welcome and incorporate pretty much anyone, any ideas, any thoughts and values in one way, shape or another. And that's as much as I would go into defining it, other than letting the lawyers do it when they have to.
Well, I mean, interestingly, it's not defined in the Constitution. It's not in the Charter of Rights. So when Don Mills and CRA pose a question like that in a poll and come out with a result of two-thirds of Atlantic Canadians are in favor of screening for Canadian values, it's completely worthless. And it starts a conversation with a flawed starting point. If you're leaving it up to Canadians to define their own set of Canadian values, then how can that be implemented into some sort of formal immigration process? I found the poll to be obscene, to be honest with you. CRA does questionable work at the best of times, and on this front, Don Mills has absolutely dropped the ball. If you ask me what Canadian values are, I will tell you, having lived in Western Canada and being a born and bred Newfoundlander, it's regional at best. And I think what it does signify, even though I've quite plainly said I think the poll results are completely and utterly worthless, to pretend that Canadians are the welcoming, open-armed, empathetic, tolerant people that we pretend we are, it's simply not true. So if this does nothing but start a conversation so that we open up our eyes and realize that there's a lot of very conservative people in the country, there may indeed be people concerned with security and their jobs, but there's also a racist underbelly in this country that if we don't acknowledge it and discuss it, we are missing the point entirely, just like Don Mills did.
Do you think that that's maybe the issue, is the fact that we like to think that all the racism and all the hatred that's happening racially and immigration issues all happens in the States, but it's not really happening in Canada? Are we just delusional with that?
Yeah, it's in the States, I think, is the common conversation now. And before sort of this uptick with the Trump presidency and all the discussions around, you know, that and comments made there, previous, it used to be historically, so people used to talk about it like it was something that happened in the past and not necessarily as much now. Mm-hmm. But it was only, you only had to look back, I think it was in 2010 in Nova Scotia, that the very first case of a cross burning actually went through the courts in Canada. So, I mean, it's a here and now issue. I think Patty's right. I think it's something that it's about time that we come around to confronting it and recognizing that there's no hard line between Canada and the U.S. when it comes to these kind of issues. And I think there's still a lot of room to get into our own personal recognition of just how deep it goes.
And to begin that conversation, I think, in any pragmatic fashion, requires Canadians to understand what the immigration policy is, number one, and how screening actually works. We think there's a big difference between someone who applies for a work visa, someone who applies for a student visa, is caught crossing illegally, or has applied for any type of status under any visa program. Every single person, even if you're walking through the snow and end up in Manitoba, you go back to the Border Security Agency and begin the screening process. So Canadians are being asked to gauge their own thought process on values and safety and immigration based on not knowing what it actually is in reality. Canadians, I think by and large, we have a fair starting point in our own minds collectively or individually about what we feel as Canadians insofar as our tolerance and acceptance. But we are starting to involve ourselves in a conversation. And if you look at the Prime Minister, I mean, I'm neither a critic of nor a supporter of Trudeau in any real gangbusters percentage-wise. But I'll tell you what, he has set us up for disastrous conversation here. He has pretended that immigration under Stephen Harper was all about political will versus legitimate conversation about safety, security, jobs, and what we mean when we screen people. So we're coming from a flawed starting point where if you listen to Mr. Trudeau, the Prime Minister, pardon me, it's all a bed of roses, unicorns, and puppies. But a lot of Canadians are legitimately worried about a variety of things, including their safety, security, their job, and what this whole thing about being a Muslim is, and Sharia law, about M103, the motion in the House of Commons today, actually means. If we don't have people in leadership positions willing to boil it down to legitimate conversation, we're going to keep tiptoeing around the edges and being asked what we individually think about Canadian values as opposed to where are we as a country. And if that doesn't get leadership, we will have a fractured citizenry, and we are destined to make some big boos.
Yeah, and I'm just going to jump in there and say these conversations, it's important to also remember, they're not happening in a vacuum. You know, it's not that Canada is sitting here deciding, should we talk about this as, you know, we like immigrants, quote unquote, or don't like immigrants, quote unquote. We need immigrants, period.
Sure.
You know, we're looking for immigrants. We're out there trying to get as many people as we can to come to this country because our numbers are dropping. They're dropping fast. And we need the bodies here, purely first and foremost, for a number of different reasons, going straight to our economics. Coming from that, I think, is you're seeing a change in Canadian society. You're seeing new Canadians who don't match up with the stereotypical idea of what is a Canadian. And it's that image of that European individual, that white individual. And suddenly we're all starting to sort of come to terms with a lot of the history also at the same time around Aboriginal Canadians and the cultural genocide that happened there. And I think it's important to realize that these things are coming together at the same time. And so it's not just, you know, is Canada like Trump America or not?
Can we have
not?
Those conversations separately or do they belong together? Because the indigenous issue and the history and residential schools and a variety of other matters that persist today, can that conversation happen in conjunction with immigration modern day? I don't know if it can.
I think fundamentally, first and foremost, we need to recognize the difference between what we're talking about in each case.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, understand that we are trying to incorporate both people coming from outside of Canada and people who are already here into, I'm thinking in case of labor, you know, the workforce that we have right now. You know, it's well recognized that Aboriginals haven't seen the same kind of job opportunities, for instance. You know, if you don't have an opportunity to, or it's something like, for instance, in Muskrat Falls, where you see cases where there's allegations of racism, it puts a chill in terms of certain types of work that people may think about as being open or not to them. So, you know, when you're having these discussions, I think, if anything, they should go into the silos of, for instance, labor or social need, as opposed to trying to divide it between Aboriginal and not Aboriginal.
Even though they dovetailed very nicely, the economic driver conversation, I think, is important. I'm sorry, Mark,
go ahead.
The economic driver or the importance of population growth, whether that come in the form of Western Europeans or, God forbid, from any Canadians, some darker-skinned people coming from Muslim-dominated nations, if we don't start with that pragmatic point, and I think you're spot on here, Ashley, people need to realize that there's a population growth strategy involved with immigration. It's not just about screening for security and Canadian values and such foolishness. You know, pardon me, it's not foolishness if we talk about it in realistic ways so far as screening goes, but if you're on the side of people like Kelly Leach, then it is absolutely beyond foolish. It's actually very dangerous. So the economic conversation, I think, is a good starting point.
But if 68% of this poll, whether it's valid or not, it's a strong number. So if they're wanting or voting for some sort of cultural values, of screening of some sort of value system, what are they voting for then if it's undefinable and if we're not really sure what we're even talking about? Where are those 68% of people coming from?
It's actually Ramsey Sedge said once, you know, be careful of generalizations. And I think when you get polls like this, that's exactly what they're falling into. I mean, to me, it absolutely represents nothing. There is no real value coming out of that. You know, talk to me about, you know, rural Newfoundland and Labrador, specifically, say, central Newfoundland, some of the communities there. You know, what are we seeing in terms of changes? What are we seeing in terms of what's working and attracting new immigrants and not? What are we seeing in terms of overt racist events and not? And let's have a public conversation around that. That has valued us as a society dwelling on a high-level number that's supposed to represent all of Canada that might come from one or two individuals. You know, in terms of speaking to ratio, is a little bit crazy to me. It's just really doesn't have the value of sitting down and having more concrete discussions.
Absolutely. As journalists, you guys, and specifically honing in on Newfoundland itself, do you guys see a positive reaction to immigration here in general, or? And also with the older and the younger generation, do you see more positivity with younger people versus older people, or maybe the opposite?
Well, I think you hit on a key point, Emily. The generational divide regarding immigration is massive. People, say, my parents' age, they have a much different view of immigration and who represents what values or their ability to assimilate or integrate, vastly different than mine and yours. I think beyond the age demographics, there's a rural versus urban equation here that is yet to be addressed. If you have a lack of job security, then you will be potentially anti-immigration because you think you're in line first, and you think that you deserve the job first. And you see people that have got their hands out for the government support, whether it be in the form of subsidy or housing or tied me over money for the first year of your migrant or immigrant status. I think there's a big divide in urban versus rural. So there's no easy answer to that question. But what we have to do is recognize that we have got a starting point where Canadians are absolutely individually opposed to each other's set of values. They're opposed individually and partisan-wise with Trudeau's policy and to pretending that it's political will that drives immigration. So this conversation has got derailed before we even started it. If we are going to have a leadership vacuum, then this is going to be as divisive in Canada as it has been in the United States.
I'm going to just hit me with that question one more time.
The basic reaction of this province to immigration, especially in versus younger versus older as well.
Yeah. Right. You know? So I think it's really interesting because growing up, there was always, because I grew up in St. John's, and there was always a really interesting sort of view of immigration where you saw people associated with the university. You saw a lot of, for instance, we got some doctors coming from outside of the province who had different cultural backgrounds and would be identified specifically because of that. And it would always be positive. As you saw more and more people coming in, it seems like there's suddenly now a change in the tone. I don't think there's a year, it's definitely not a year gone by, but I don't think there's, say, a month that's gone by without me hearing at least one instance of something that makes me incredibly uncomfortable as an individual in terms of an overt, and I would say, racist incident. Sometimes you see it in the news, sometimes it's just, you know, you hear it from a friend of a friend. I don't know if it's because I'm older, I'm hearing more of it, I'm seeing more of it, but it does feel like there's a difference between, say, now and 20, 30 years ago. Now, having said that, I can't exactly say what to what I would subscribe that, I guess. But it is interesting.
Memorial is an absolutely different piece of this conversation. They have a multicultural atmosphere and attitude there that I think is vastly different than the rest of the province. And insofar as the complaints we hear, and you and I in our business, we get a lot of emails and phone calls. I would suggest that many of the people who put up the biggest stink and make something out of a so-called racist or provocative comment or display made, sometimes we exaggerate that to make it seem as if, my God, this person is Gert Wilders versus has just a legitimate question. So I think there's something inside that. And it's the same reason why today I saw you tweet that you had a couple of calls in the newsroom that said, why are we celebrating Gander for Come From Away and the 9/11 issue versus St. John's? The same people would like to make a mountain out of every molehill that makes itself apparent in this province. And I think the same thing with immigration. And for all the right-wing ideology and things that are part of this conversation. Tuning out some of those voices will probably go a long way to getting ahead.
Yeah. I will say, though, just very quickly, is that every single day, we get comments to our website that aren't seen by the public. They're caught through our moderator process that are just so inexplicably vile that there's just such an undercurrent to them. And I know what you're saying in terms of tuning them out, and I think it's important because I think there has been so much tuning out in recent years. Maybe it's time to even let it in just a little bit more to, I guess, add to that conversation or spark the conversation.
Unless these people have anything to actually offer versus their built-in characteristic of just being a complainer. And everything that touches them and everything they see doesn't suit them and they complain about it. So you're right. We have to allow all sides of the conversation to have a good one. And you talk about the comments we don't see on your website. My email inbox would make you cry. It's horrific. And things that people are willing to say, especially behind a keyboard, and I don't think we've touched on it quite yet, this rise of ideology that is anti-immigration has found itself a home in the echo chamber of social media. And some of these people, look, they may have some legitimate points to make, but it's the first time in their lives they've ever been applauded or celebrated, and because of it, their chest has puffed out, and their commentary has become more and more severe, more and more harsh, and we're creating a bigger divide than necessary because we don't have real conversations about this. Yeah.
We've got just about a minute left in this segment, but I just want to follow on with that idea, and I'm going to ask you to answer briefly. But we spoke with some people who are very vocal about being very anti-immigration, for example. I know you've chatted with a few of them on your Open Line show. I guarantee
it.
The question is, if a person says, I worry about jobs, I worry about limited resources going, and we're letting immigrants in, are they racist, or are they? Do they have a point to make?
Oh, absolutely. They and should be given room to make their point. I think the cutoff has to be when you start hearing things that can incite hateful activity, because that's actually a legal line. Now, it's tricky when you're having, say, a live radio conversation to determine mm-hmm. exactly where that line sits.
Right.
But I think when you come to rational, here's my ABC line of thinking on that, then very much, you know, let's hear those people out. But, you know, between you and me, it's a very, very difficult argument to make that at this point in time, we shouldn't be having more people coming into this province.
If you're talking about jobs and security, you have a legitimate point to make. It's the same thing as if you're so willing to scream racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia. It's like screaming fire in a movie theater. Just because you hear something that might be contrary to a left-wing welcoming ideology doesn't mean that in and of itself it's racism. It's the same thing for both sides. If you take an extreme position on the left and or the right, you're probably wrong. And somewhere in the middle where level-headed people can reign supreme and have a bigger impact in the conversation, it's probably room for it. But I hesitate to say you're a racist because you're worried about your job, because I'm worried about my job. And I'm very welcoming and supportive of all the immigration policies that I think make sense and legitimate screening process for security. And yes, to maybe, God forbid, pick someone that actually fills a need in the job market in this country. So screaming racism right away is legitimately derailing a conversation once again.
And it's where I think specificity can help. So sure. If we're more specific about the discussions around what's in new policies being introduced, then we can get a better understanding of exactly who we're opening the doors to and saying, come on in. We want you even before the guy is standing next to you.
Absolutely.
Well, I think, thank you guys so much for being here today. And I think this is a really important conversation to have, especially right now. So I just wanted to tell you like how appreciative we are that you came in and took time out to talk about this.
Well, I think it's great that you guys are blocking out the time for the conversation. So.
And I'm really pleased to be here. And everyone should learn from this. A real conversation about this can only be helpful, not a detraction. So let's keep it going.
Before we go, I just want to remind all of our listeners to visit our Facebook page. Visit our website, rather. It's www.kicker.cna-nl.com. If there was ever a show that we've done that requires commenting, it's this one for sure. So please give us your feedback for sure.
So what does racism mean to you?
I think it means that my race is better than everybody else's.
Racism is when people discriminate against other people or are not the same as they are.
Racism is people that is not of your race and you don't like them.
Do you feel that President Trump has made it more socially acceptable to be a racist?
I think he... Yes, yes, I do.
I think that Donald Trump, first, is a racist, and while trying to outwardly appear not to be, he most certainly does kind of inadvertently spread racist thoughts and feelings, and is really promoting racism in the American culture.
And welcome back to our second half hour of our Kicker Radio show. Just want to say thank you again to Patty Daly and Ashley Fitzpatrick for being here. It was a great conversation. Yeah, really enjoyed it. Martin, tell our listeners what they can expect in the second half hour now.
Absolutely. Coming up in this next half hour, we're going to sit down with Justin Campbell. He's with the Association for New Canadians. We're going to talk to him about the work the association is doing for new immigrants to the province. We're also going to discuss some tweets from local residents who are very opposed to immigration to the province. It should be a good conversation.
Yeah, I think so. But before we get to that, here's Erica again with the news.
Thank you, Emily.
A new report released yesterday by CRA as a part of their Atlantic Quarterly Telephone Survey shows that two-thirds of Atlantic Canadians support potential immigrants being screened for Canadian values. The results are consistent across Atlantic Canada, with 68% of residents being completely or mostly supportive of increased screening. In other news, Kicker Radio is talking about racism this week. Racism can ruin a child's life, but not at Holy Heart High School. The school community comes together to support one another and rise above racism together. Kicker's Josh White tells us more.
Holy Heart High School in St. John's is rising above racism. The school has a tradition of welcoming students from all around the world. Principal Sheldon Berry says that this makes the school a better place.
It certainly gives the school a very clear perspective on the world. We're not just a small collection of individuals. We're now represented by people with different viewpoints, different religions, different philosophies of education from over 60 countries.
Berry adds that everyone, no matter who they are, is welcome.
It's a culture within the school that any student that comes here is part of the school, no matter where they're from.
Debbie House is the assistant principal with Holy Heart. She says that these students can bring something special to the classroom and can be themselves when they come to school.
The richness of their heritage and culture and their perspective often on being new citizens to Newfoundland and to our country. So there's a richness of their language and the celebrations they have and the festivals and all those things. And, you know, it just brings a richness to our whole building. Students, whether they're international students or other nationalities or our own kids, can come in and just be whoever they want to be. They can dress however they want to dress. They can act however they want to act. And people don't mind. You can be very individualistic here in the building.
While racism is not going away, Holy Heart High School has found a way to overcome this and make the school a much better place. For Kicker Radio, I'm Josh White.
For the past few weeks, Kicker has been working on a continual series about rural Newfoundland. The series details the struggles throughout the outports of the island. In our latest story, Kicker's Kyle Greenham spoke with the photographer behind the popular Facebook page, Last Newfoundland.
Rotting houses with no one to care for them or even tear them down. It's a common sight all over Newfoundland. A bleak look into a way of life that is fading away. St. John's photographer Steve Campbell has created the Facebook page Lost Newfoundland to document this very phenomenon.
I've got pictures of old pickup trucks, old machinery, you know, all sorts of old things like, you know, things from the past in Newfoundland, so to speak, that I figured people would think was interesting. But, I mean, I mostly went with the houses, and that, geez, seems like I'm not the only one who likes that sort of thing, right? Some of them, you know, really work out really well from just a photography perspective. You know, you got an old house in a bleak landscape. You know, you can work with that, you know?
Taking his camera to communities across the Avalon, Campbell finds torn and mangled sheds, cars, and homes. While no one knows how long these houses will stand, Campbell preserves them digitally.
The houses have a story, and you wonder what it is, who lived there, what happened, how did, you know, one house, same-sized style house, is still sitting there with someone living in it, and another similar house, a couple of doors up, has just been sitting there empty for 20, 30, 40 years, you know. And, I mean, when I put those photos on Flickr, they would never have any information. I put them on Lost Newfoundland now. Somebody has the information and the history of the house for me almost immediately. Now I've actually gotten the stories behind the houses. In a lot of cases, people have even sent me old pictures of the house when somebody was living in it years ago.
One of Campbell's most popular works was on the abandoned amusement park in Trinity Loop. The images are haunting. A rusting Ferris wheel, a damaged dining car, a piano that hasn't been played in a decade. He hopes to soon travel out to Western Newfoundland to garner more photos for the series.
There's lots of parts of the island I'm planning to go to, but you need a few weeks off, and you need to plan around a big trip around it to get out to the West Coast, or, you know, which is where I like to go, so hopefully this summer I'll be able to find a few more places before they're all gone.
Lost Newfoundland currently has over 13,000 likes on Facebook and is updated with new images weekly.
Mostly it was either fishermen's homes or people that lived a more traditional way of life. And I guess with the declining populations in the outports, the collapse of the fishery, A lot of people just don't want to live there anymore. It's a different way of life that's pretty much gone now. I mean, based around the fishery, based around a more simple lifestyle. And I think that, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of that. And these houses are just a glimpse back to the past.
Kyle Grenham, Kicker Radio.
If you liked what you heard today, you can find more stories done by our Kicker team on our website, kicker.cna-nl.com. If there ever was a time that we needed your feedback, it's definitely today after this controversial discussion.
All right, well, thanks, Erica. Once again, we have Mr. Kyle Grenham here with the latest in weather and traffic. Kyle, what's happening out there today?
Sure. Here's a little less controversial news, I think, weather and traffic.
Unless you're talking potholes. No, it's not
controversial at all. I guess not. This is going to rile people up now, yeah. Well, I'll start with weather first. Now it's the clouds are coming in over here from our window in K109 studio, so looks like we may get some flurries tonight. They're calling for a 40% chance, low of -2 over the evening. And tomorrow morning, there's a chance of flurries again, 40%, and it's going to be mostly a cloudy day with winds gusting to 20 to 40 kilometers and a high of +1. Now in traffic, there's no update if the collision at Topsail Road and Cohen Ave has been removed. But it could be still there, so traffic might be moving slow down Topsail Road. There's lots of potholes around town, as I'm sure most drivers are aware. There's a really bad pothole on Ruth Avenue to Pitts West that you're going to want to stop and get around, or else you might lose a rim or something. Another one off a Team Gushu ramp on the outer ring going west. There's still some traffic lights out. They were replacing lights on Prince Philip and Thorburn earlier today, and on Topsail Road from Brookfield to Dunn, there's no power until 10 p.m. And the snow is clearing, though, so it looks like it might be a decent day for driving.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. Thank you, Kyle. And now we have Josh back for another sports update. How's she looking, Josh?
All right. Well, how are you guys doing?
We're doing pretty good.
Yeah, as I talked about before, we're going to be talking about the playoffs. And we're only 2 weeks away from the playoffs, and it's a very, very tight race in the Atlantic Division. As of right now, Montreal has 86 points, Ottawa 85, and Boston only has 82, so that's a very tight division. I personally think Montreal is going to win the division, but you never know, right? As of right now, a potential wild card situation could be the New York Rangers versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. Who do you think I would win that? I think the Toronto Maple Leafs has a very good chance of winning that series. Dude, like, they just had a phenomenal, phenomenal season under the coaching of Mike Babcock. Marner, Nylander, Matthews, the big three, as I said a couple weeks ago in my other sports preview. Just a great team this year. In the West, there's a wild card, Edmonton and St. Louis. Right now, I think Edmonton is the underdog. They have not been in the playoffs since 2006. Yes, you heard that correctly, 11 years. McDavid, a phenomenal captain, and Patrick Maroon, he's just been a phenomenal player this year. Now, there is a team that's not in the playoffs right now, but only 1 point out of a playoff spot, and that is Tampa Bay. They are very close to the second wild card, and even with their star captain Steven Stamkos out of the lineup, and with the trade of Ben Bishop to the LA Kings, it seems like this team has new confidence and are willing to win. During the next sports update, we're going to be talking about the ultimate thrill ride, WrestleMania 33 from Orlando, Florida. It's back to you guys.
I'm going to be honest with you, Josh. Half of that was gibberish, but I always love your enthusiasm every week.
I'm going to be honest. All of that was gibberish.
And coming up in the studio, we have our own Johnny Hodder with an in-studio guest. They will be discussing racism surrounding indigenous groups in the province. But first, here's Eastern Owl with The Fast.
I'm Johnny Hodder, and you've been listening to Kicker. We are covering racism today, all forms of racism in Newfoundland and Labrador. This week's show, we're talking about discrimination. We're trying to cover as many different angles as we can. So people often think of racism and discrimination in terms of how it affects people who move here from other countries. But what about discrimination against people who have been living here for centuries? Joining me in studio is Catherine Anderson. She's a special advisor to the president of Aboriginal Affairs at Memorial University and worked extensively with the Nunatsiavut government in Labrador. Today, she's here to talk about the changing relationship between Aboriginal groups and non-Indigenous people living in Newfoundland and Labrador. Ms. Anderson, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll just get right in here. What can you tell us about your work as an advisor with the Aboriginal Affairs Office in Memorial University?
So my role at the university is to provide leadership and coordination around Aboriginal initiatives. So it's pan-university, everything from in things involved with academic programming to student support services to research. I'm obviously very... I'm not someone that gets down into the weeds of things, but provide support and provide guidance to various units and people within the university.
Right. And so what does, from the Aboriginal and Indigenous point of view, what does that sort of discrimination look like today in modern Newfoundland culture?
Discrimination for Aboriginal people?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think it comes in so many different forms and in so many different ways. Sometimes it can be overt racism, and sometimes it can be something that you might not need even be able to really put your finger on, but it's so maybe like a microaggression. So something that you might not really say, but when you hear it once, it's too bad. I'll try to describe it, but I've had microaggressions explained to me this way before. So the first time you experience it, it might not affect you too much. But if you experience it on a day to day or day after day, it's like tapping your hand. And the first few times, it's no big deal. But if you keep doing this and keep doing it, then it starts to really have an impact. Right. And that's what microaggressions can be.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the more pressing issues that you see in terms of Aboriginal culture and how it's interacting with non-Indigenous culture and where they meet?
I would say it's a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding, a lack of awareness of Aboriginal peoples. And I think that stems back to when Newfoundland joined Confederation. And Joey Smallwood said that there were no natives on the island. So that, you know, or in Newfoundland. And for Newfoundland and Labrador, to not acknowledge that there were Aboriginal people here, that just kind of erases us from the history. And we see that, for example, in curriculum in K-12, there's very little that's taught about the Aboriginal peoples in the province. And you see that right across the country. It's almost like this erasure of Aboriginal peoples. So not only are Aboriginal people not seeing themselves reflected in educational materials, for example, so when they're going to school, but non-Aboriginal people are really denied the opportunity to learn about Aboriginal people. And that's something that I see and hear very frequently, is that people don't have that comfort level because they don't have that basic knowledge of even who the Aboriginal people are in this province.
Right, and I think that's something that comes down with the education system, is that, like you said, Aboriginal people are being denied their ability to learn about their own culture, but then Newfoundlander and Labradorians and non-Indigenous people, European descent or whatever you want to call it, they're denied that part of the history because it's considered a darker part of the history. And like you said, Joey Smallwood basically shoved it under the rug. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, in order to learn more about it, in order to address it properly and fix it, you kind of have to have it out in the open. But what you were talking about with the whole idea of identity, when you were growing up yourself, is that a major part of your own identity?
Absolutely.
And has it changed over time, like from when you were a child to now? Like, has your own outlook changed?
I don't know about my outlook, but I guess in terms of identity, yes, it's always been... I grew up in a small town in northern Labrador in Nunatsiavut. I've always identified as Inuit. I'm biracial, so my father is Inuk and my mother is white. And in northern Labrador, there was always a distinction between Inuit and Kalunangayuit. And a Kalunangayuk, the singular of Kalunangayuit, is someone who has mixed heritage. So for a while, I identified as Kalunangayuk. And then later, I began to
Actually, it was a friend of mine who I went to university with in Ontario said, and she came, she was biracial as well, and said, you know, you're Inuk. I'm an Inuk. You're an Inuk. We're Inuit. So yeah.
Okay. And so we're kind of rounding down here now. I also brought you in because Aboriginal Peoples Week is coming up next week from the 20th to the 24th. So what can we expect from that? Like, what's being planned?
It's a fantastic week of events, and I would encourage everyone to come down to some of the events. We have some events that are, more for the university community in terms of the forums, where we'll be looking at how Memorial can respond to the calls to action, principles on Indigenous education. But we've also got some other informational sessions and cultural sessions where we explore and raise awareness around Aboriginal peoples.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so they can check out all the full event information online?
Yep. www.mun.ca/reconciliation.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being here today, and I look forward to attending some of the events next week.
Thank you so much.
All right, and that was Kelly Loader. She's CNA's own Kelly Loader, I should say, with a song called Drift. Before that, we had a great conversation with Johnny Hodder and his guest. That was really interesting, actually.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed that. She was so talkative and just so good at conversation, I feel like, you know?
Absolutely. We're going to keep the ball rolling here. Right now, we have Justin Campbell in studio with us. Justin is with the Association for New Canadians. Justin, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for inviting me on. I think this is a really important issue that you're discussing, so I'm happy to be part of the conversation.
We're happy to have you here.
Absolutely. So first of all, tell us a little bit about the work the association does and your role with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Association for New Canadians is a nonprofit, non-governmental, community-based organization in St. John's with a mandate to help integrate newcomers in St. John's and across the province. So we're talking about immigrants and refugees. And to do that, we provide a full range of programming to help provide for settlement. So everything from the moment a newcomer arrives in the province to the moment they become a citizen, we provide everything to help bridge that gap. So you can imagine that's quite an extensive list of things. We're talking about employment support. We're talking about English language training. We're talking about settlement workers in the schools helping children integrate into the system, things like that.
Now, we talked earlier about how friendly we are here in Newfoundland, or at least that's how we're portrayed, and you see the truth of immigration firsthand. How welcoming are Newfoundlanders to people outside of the country?
Well, I would have to disagree a little bit with what some of your previous guests have said. I do think that it is commonly said that Newfoundlanders and Labradorians, in particular among Canadians, are especially welcoming. And I think there is a substantial amount of truth to that. And a perfect example is the response that we had from the community, from ordinary people, with the Syrian influx last year in 2016. So during that time period, the Association for New Canadians, obviously with the help of the province and the federal government, helped welcome 410 refugees, not all of them from Syria, but a good number of them from Syria, helped them make this province their home. And I mean, we have a very large staff. We've got 60 full-time staff to do that, but there's no way that we can tackle that challenge on our own. So we depend heavily on the volunteers to do that kind of work to help us with that. And the community saw that. They understood that settlement is necessarily a community project, and they came out in full force to help with that, everything from volunteering their time to donating household goods to volunteering, helping people learn English. So we've seen really strong community support there. So I think that really does actually match up with the self-image in general that people have in this province as being welcoming and friendly, especially when it comes to newcomers.
It's funny because we see a big discussion about immigration and what it really means for the province, for the country. Mm. We've talked earlier about core Canadian values and whatever that means, stuff like that as well. Mm. We had a chance to chat with two gentlemen who are certainly have concerns and are opposed to widespread immigration into the province. They've given us the opportunity to actually include their tweets here on the air today.
Okay.
I want to read you a couple of them just as starting points for the conversation. We have a few minutes in this segment left, but I just want to see your reactions to them. Alrighty.
Okay. Yeah.
So we had one gentleman, and again, they've allowed us to use their names as well. His name is Corey Chalk. He says, "My point, Newfoundlanders and Canadians, a lot of us suffer when immigrants, not all immigrants, find great success." What do you say to that?
Well, I would find the sentiment a little bit puzzling because it's putting the success of immigrants who have become Canadians by virtue of immigrating here. How is their success at odds with the success of anyone else in the country? When immigrants do well, the rest of the country does well. People come here. Immigrants especially have more of an entrepreneurial spirit, and we've measured that. It's measurably larger than for people born in this country. They start new businesses. They become self-employed. They generate economic activity in the province and in the country. So when immigration is inherently an economic thing, and when the economy does well, it makes it easier for everyone else in the country to do well. So I don't really understand why this person seems to think that those two things are opposed to each other.
I want to continue on with something else that he said as well. Continuing on with that, the idea is that instead of bringing immigrants in, they should perhaps lower the cost of tuitions, maybe make it free for Canadians to actually afford to go to college, to make housing more affordable. He said it's awful that people born in this country, in a lot of cases, can't afford to get an education or a home, and yet immigrants seem to have a free ride.
Okay, I would say, again, it doesn't really seem to be a fully informed opinion when you start to look at the evidence here because, first of all, we could all agree that certainly education is an excellent public good. It's good for individuals. It's good for society to have high levels of education. So the objective that he's trying to achieve is certainly good there, but if that is the objective, then it really argues in favor of increasing immigration, particularly in a province like Newfoundland and Labrador, where one of the biggest economic constraints we have is a widely dispersed population. So trying to provide public services to a population, a relatively small population across vast areas of space, is a huge challenge and it's expensive. When population levels increase, then you can actually lower the cost per capita of providing those services. So if the problem that this person wants to address is we don't have enough public resources to address those kinds of concerns, then he should actually be in favor of immigration.
Absolutely. Do you think that's a widespread belief, though? Do you think maybe that's the misconception, is that there's a limited resources, so therefore there's not enough to go around, so why bring more people in?
I think it maybe goes to the need for a little bit more education around economics and how the economy actually functions.
Makes sense.
It's all about cooperation and collaboration. When, like I said before, when some people do good, it makes it easier for others to do good, right? We're in this together.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's how you can achieve common ends, is by working together.
Absolutely. Justin, I can't believe this is the end of the segment already. That flew by like crazy. Justin, thank you so much for coming in. Certainly, like we said, this is certainly a conversation that needs to keep going. Please visit our website, www.kicker.cna-nl.com. It's time for comments for sure. And again, we thank you for coming in.
Great. Thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much.
Welcome back to the final half hour of our show today. Goodness, the whole thing is just flying by. I can't even believe it. Coming up, we will chat with Father Paul Lundergan and Haseen Khan about the religious faith, how religious faith plays into racism. But for the last time, here is our own Erica Yetman with the news.
A new report released by CRA as a part of their Atlantic Quarterly Telephone Survey shows that two-thirds of Atlantic Canadians support potential immigrants being screened for Canadian values. The results are consistent across Atlantic Canada, with 68% of residents being completely or mostly supportive of the increased screening. In other news, Kicker Radio is talking about racism this week. Racism can ruin a child's life, but not at Holy Heart High School. The school community comes together to support one another and rise above racism together. Kicker's Josh White tells us more.
Holy Heart High School in St. John's is rising above racism. The school has a tradition of welcoming students from all around the world. Principal Sheldon Berry says that this makes the school a better place.
It certainly gives the school a very clear perspective on the world. We're not just a small collection of individuals were now represented by people with different viewpoints, different religions, different philosophies of education from over 60 countries.
Berry adds that everyone, no matter who they are, is welcome.
It's a culture within the school that any student that comes here is part of the school, no matter where they're from.
Debbie House is the assistant principal with Holy Heart. She says that these students can bring something special to the classroom and can be themselves when they come to school.
The richness of their heritage and culture and their perspective often on being new citizens to Newfoundland and to our country. So there's a richness of their language and the celebrations they have and the festivals and all of those things, and you know, it just brings a richness to our whole building. Students, whether they're international students or other nationalities or our own kids, can come in and just be whoever they want to be. They can dress however they want to dress. They can act however they want to act. And people don't, you know, people don't mind. You can be very individualistic here in the building.
While racism is not going away, Holy Heart High School has found a way to overcome this and make the school a much better place. For Kicker Radio, I'm Josh White.
For the past few weeks, Kicker has been working on a continual series about rural Newfoundland. The series details the struggles throughout the outports of the island. In our latest story, Kicker's Kyle Greenham spoke with the photographer behind the popular Facebook page Lost Newfoundland.
Rotting houses with no one to care for them or even tear them down. It's a common sight all over Newfoundland. A bleak look into a way of life that is fading away. St. John's photographer Steve Campbell has created the Facebook page Lost Newfoundland to document this very phenomenon.
I've got pictures of old pickup trucks, old machinery, you know, all sorts of old things, like, you know, things from the past in Newfoundland, so to speak, that I figured people would think was interesting. But I mean, I mostly went with the houses, and that, geez, seems like I'm not the only one who likes that sort of thing, right? Some of them, you know, really work out really well from just a photography perspective. You know, you got an old house in a bleak landscape. You know, you can work with that, you know.
Taking his camera to communities across the Avalon, Campbell finds torn and mangled sheds, cars, and homes. While no one knows how long these houses will stand, Campbell preserves them digitally.
The houses have a story, and you wonder what it is, who lived there, what happened, how did, you know, one house, same-sized style house, is still sitting there with someone living in it, and another similar house a couple of doors up has just been sitting there empty for 20, 30, 40 years, you know. And, I mean, when I put those photos on Flickr, they would never have any information. I put them on Lost Newfoundland now. Somebody has the information and the history of the house for me almost immediately. Now I've actually gotten the stories behind the houses. In a lot of cases, people have even sent me old pictures, pictures of the house when somebody was living in it years ago.
One of Campbell's most popular works was on the abandoned amusement park in Trinity Loop. The images are haunting. A rusting Ferris wheel, a damaged dining car, a piano that hasn't been played in a decade. He hopes to soon travel out to Western Newfoundland to garner more photos for the series.
There's lots of parts of the island I'm planning to go to, but you need a few weeks off, and you need to plan a big trip around it to get out to the West Coast, or, you know, which is where I like to go, so hopefully this summer I'll be able to find a few more places before they're all gone.
Lost Newfoundland currently has over 13,000 likes on Facebook and is updated with new images weekly.
Mostly it was either fishermen's homes or people that lived a more traditional way of life. And I guess with the declining populations in the outports, the collapse of the fishery, a lot of people just don't want to live there anymore. It's a different way of life that's pretty much gone now. I mean, based around the fishery, based around a more simple lifestyle. And I think that, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of that. And these houses are just a glimpse back to the past.
Kyle Grenham, Kicker Radio.
If you liked what you heard today, you can find more stories done by our Kicker team on our website, kicker.cna-nl.com. Your feedback would be greatly appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you again, Erica. The time is 4:06, so it means it's time to go to Kyle Grenham once again, the final weather and traffic update.
Yep, the moment everyone's been waiting for.
Can't wait.
Weather and traffic. All right. So we got a collision at Topsail Road and Cohen Avenue. And it's slowing traffic in every direction there on Topsail, so I'm sure rush hour is probably going to be extra annoying to those folks down there. There's some potholes around town.
some nasty potholes around Stefanger, where I'm from. I got to swerve from lane to lane every morning, you know. I'm usually 180 is my minimum when I'm driving to school in the morning, so. Anyways, there's a nasty pothole on Ruth Avenue to Pitts West, and there's another one off of Team Gushu Ramp on the Outer Ring going west, so make sure you slow down there when you're coming up that way. There are traffic lights still out in the city from the storm. They're replacing lights on Prince Philip and Thorburn, though they might be cleared there now. And on Topsail Road from Brookfield to Dunn, there is no power until 10 p.m. tonight, so there's going to be some four-way stops at those traffic lights. But the snow is clearing. I'm sure some drivers are happy to be able to see around the corners better now, and who knows, might have motorcycle weather soon.
Yeah.
Well, can always dream, okay? Anyways, so with weather tonight, we got about a 40% chance of flurries, low of -3, and winds going from about 20 to 40 kilometers. And tomorrow, they're now calling for a high of +3, which doesn't sound too bad. There's another 40% chance of flurries, though, and winds gusting from 20 to 40 kilometers. So back to you guys.
All right, thank you, Kyle. Absolutely heartbroken that you're leaving us.
But if you're checking the Facebook feed, you can check out Kyle's brand new haircut. It's looking fantastic. It really is fantastic. Worth seeing.
And one last time on our show, we're going to talk with Josh White about sports. Hello, Josh.
Hello, how are you guys?
We're good, thank
terrific,
you.
Terrific.
Now, it will be the Roman Reigns versus The Undertaker at WrestleMania 33. What do you expect, and who do you expect to win?
Well, what do I expect? Well, first of all, this feud started at the Royal Rumble when Roman Reigns actually eliminated Undertaker from the match. What to expect? I know Undertaker is in his 50s, and he's starting to get up there, and he only performs once a year at WrestleMania. So, in quality, expect a 3 out of 5-star match. I think I want Undertaker to win, but I highly think that Roman's winning because WWE pushes Roman very far. So I think we'll see Roman win at WrestleMania.
All right. Well, if anybody knows me, they know, obviously, my love of WrestleMania. Wow.
Does he ever shut up about it?
I know. I go on and on. Here's my question for you. Goldberg is once again the world champion. Do you expect him to walk out of Orlando with the title again?
No, I don't. Well, we saw it Fastlane just 2 weeks ago on live on the WWE Network. He beat Kevin Owens for the title in a record 26 seconds. So apparently rumors going around that his contract is going to end after WrestleMania, and Brock Lesnar's contract is till 2018. Right. So from what I expect is, I know at Survivor Series back in Toronto, back in November actually, the two faced off and Goldberg beat Lesnar in a squash, a minute and 26 seconds. So I think right now it's leaning towards Lesnar walking out with the title. Right. And defending it at SummerSlam because he's working on a part-time schedule. So,
but wrestling's fake, though, right?
Bite your tongue, sir. Now, Josh, before you run away, we have one last question. What match do you think will steal the show?
Well, that's a pretty good question there, but I think it's going to be the Cruiserweight Championship match. The King of the Cruiserweights, Neville, versus Austin Aries. This match actually got set up on Tuesday on 205 Live after Aries won a fatal 5-way elimination match. Austin Aries actually is a worldwide performer. He's performed everywhere, Japan, China, New Japan Pro Wrestling. I think it's going to be a great match. And I mean, the Cruiserweights has just been under the water lately, like they've just been in the dark. But I actually think this match will steal the show. And I just expect Austin Aries to walk out with the championship. And also, this is actually, speaking of WrestleMania, at Hall of Fame, Friday night before WrestleMania, it was announced by WWE on Facebook 35 minutes ago that John Cena will be inducting Kurt Angle to the Hall of Fame. So that is big news.
The one name
very
I know,
excited.
And it's only because of memes.
Yeah, it's going to be a great weekend.
I don't even know what that means. I'm not going to laugh. All right. So thank you, Josh. That was incredibly informative. I'm so glad you were here. Coming up now, we have our final panel of the day. But first, let's go to another track from Eastern Owl with a song called Millbrook Man. And that was Eastern Owl. clearly one of my new favorite bands. I love that song. That was a song called Millbrook Man. Well, right now we have with us Father Paul Lundergan of the Roman Catholic Church, and we have Haseen Khan from the Muslim Association of Newfoundland and Labrador. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much.
So religion has always been a topic of heated discussion. It's often a topic that you avoid if you don't want to get into an argument sometimes, let's be honest. It seems it's a flashpoint for racism and discrimination in Canada lately. Certainly it's an issue that we've talked about in this show already. My question to start off with, do you feel that faith plays a role in discrimination?
Oh, definitely so. Sadly, within the history of our church, the Roman Catholic Church, we've had dark periods in our history. We've also had some bright periods when our missionary people went out to spread the gospel of Christ and to bring the Christian faith to other countries. Quite often they would incorporate the practices and religious beliefs of the communities they went into, the countries they went into, which is where we get a lot of our Christmas traditions, where we incorporated trees that were being used in pagan practices, the Yule log, all that kind of thing. We incorporated it and turned them into Christian festivals so that the people wouldn't lose their culture, their faith, and their expression or understanding of God. However, at the same time, we also have very dark moments in our history when, out of a belief that our faith was the way to salvation, we not only took away people's culture and their language, they were tortured into converting, even our Jewish and Muslim brothers and sisters. That goes back several centuries, and I'd like to think that we have moved and learned and grown beyond that. But even in the last couple of centuries, in the United States, there were American bishops who owned slaves because it was seen culturally as being part of whom what we are, because the Bible and even in the gospel they talk about how to treat your slaves. So it was seen as being acceptable. And because of that, there was a real, true racism that was incorporated and taught. We've grown and evolved beyond that, and I'd like to believe that faith directs us into a better understanding of humanity and of humanity's relationship to God. And we have tried to evolve, and we're still evolving beyond that. Absolutely. Our relations are better today, but we still have a ways to go.
Haseen, what are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I will pick up where Father Paul Lundergan started. From Islamic perspective, religion plays a very, very important role in eliminating any type of discrimination. According to Islamic history, Prophet, peace be upon him, he was in a time which was a time of illiteracy, slavery, all types of discrimination, and his mission was to eradicate that slavery. And conceding that, there are two cornerstones of Islam. One is equality and second is justice. There's a very famous verse in the Holy Quran which is often quoted by scholars, and that verse conveys a very important message, that is, irrespective of our color, our race, our language, our belief, we are all members of a single human family. The verse reads as, O mankind, we created you from a single pair of male and a female, and made you into tribes and nations so that you may know each other, not that you despise each other. Certainly, the most honored of you in the sight of God is the one who is most righteous of you. This verse makes reference to Adam and Eve, that the entire human race originates from Adam and Eve. That is, we all have same parents. So what does it mean that we are all brothers and sisters in humanity, irrespective of what we believe, what we practice? And this is the cornerstone of Islam, that you have been divided into nations and tribes for a reason, and that reason is you understand each other better and you collaborate each other with each other for the benefit of the society at large.
Absolutely.
Well, I really love hearing about like the similarities you can draw between religions, no matter how different they seem to be. We've been talking a lot about Canadian values today on the show, and I'm just wondering how the two of you, from a religious standpoint, define Canadian values.
There's always been a misnomer here in Canada, aping the American idea that our country is based on a Judeo-Christian ethic. It is not. Our country was founded on the basis that there is a freedom for all people to express their beliefs as long as there is respect for the beliefs of others. However you believe in God or do not believe in God, you have the right here to practice. And we are not a Christian country. We are a country that respects all expressions of faith. And that's something that we come together to try to promote. We have a coalition here in St. John's, and there are several across the country, but we have an interfaith coalition that has representation from almost every faith perspective that is practiced here in the province. And we all come together with our common belief that we need to fix what we see as a fault in our society, a moral fault, in the huge gap between the rich and the poor. And it is based on our religious faith that all of us have this in common, that we need to take care of one another. And it has become a real touchstone, not just for working for the elimination of poverty, but also for building a better understanding of what we are as a community through our faiths.
Believe it or not, we have time for one more question. So my apologies to cut you short there. But Mr. Khan, I'm going to start with you for this final question. We talked earlier about the CRA report that was just released. We had a big discussion about the validity of that. But one of the findings in it was that a lot of Canadians that were polled feel that the Muslim community have not properly assimilated into Canadian culture. How valid do you think that point is?
I think, you see, this is it depends on how you look at it. Muslims have been in this country for about 60, 70 years, and it has been an evolving process. Yes, if you talk about older generation, maybe they did not assimilate as well as they should have, because it's an evolution. These things evolve with time. But as far as younger generation is concerned, I think they are integrating. They are adapting to Canadian values. And that takes me to the earlier question. As far as Muslims are concerned, we don't see any deviation, any contradiction between Canadian values and Islamic values. Canada is a country which strongly promotes multiculturalism. That is unity in diversity. And that is what Islam teaches. Unity in diversity, equality in diversity. So, to answer your question, I think it has been an evolving process, and I think maybe there is more work to be done in this area. But basically, I don't see any contradiction in Islamic values and Canadian values. They all talk about peace, unity, coexistence in peace and harmony. So, and as you see, younger generation, who are born and raised here, I think they are fully assimilated into the Canadian society. They are maintaining their religious identity, but at the same time, they are also proud of being Canadians. They are proud of being Canadian Muslims.
Absolutely. Do you think it boils down to just the fear of the unknown sometimes? Maybe a lack of an understanding or an education about the differences?
Definitely. Look, when you get a group that comes in and they keep themselves separate because of their faith, and they do not intermarry with other groups, and they have their women wrapped up from head to toe in black cloth, people get suspicious. Now, I'm not talking about the Muslims. I'm talking about the Roman Catholics, because that's how we dressed our nuns. And we would not intermarry with Protestants or anybody else. And we were considered, the Catholics in the early days of the country, to be suspicious. We assimilated not because we gave up our faith, but because people got used to and understood what our faith was about and how it could enrich the country. And we are discovering the same thing with the Muslim community. Well, the differences among them are not something to be feared, but are something that enriches our country and has made it a much better place in the last 60, 70 years. They have assimilated from the very beginning by not giving up their faith and pretending not to be Muslim, but by enriching our culture with the wonders of everything that they bring with their faith and their culture.
Absolutely.
I gotta tell you, I could listen to you, both of you, like, all day. But unfortunately, we are out of time. And I just wanted to say thank you both so much for being here and for having this conversation with us, because we really think it's important. And we are so glad that you decided to lend your voices to us today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. It was wonderful. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much. Pleasure.
All right. So we have one more time for one more piece. It's actually by my co-host here, Emily, to wrap it up. As we've said throughout our show, Newfoundlanders are known for friendliness, but sometimes we can let our curiosity get the best of us, especially in regards to race and ethnicity. Emily Leifer delves into the issue with this one.
What are you? What are you? What are you? I probably got that question 3 to 4 times a week.
As a Caucasian, I have never been asked this question. But it's something that Shania Jana, who identifies as an Indian Newfoundlander, has been hearing most of her life.
If they don't ask, what are you, they'll be like, so, where are you born? Newfoundland. And they're like, no, but like, were you born in India? No, I was born in Newfoundland. Like, it's where I'm from.
I wanted to know how she feels about the question, and whether or not there's a better way to ask it.
Like, I get people's curiosity, I do. But I feel like there's better ways around it. Like, so, what's your ethnicity, instead of automatically defining you by your skin color, you know what I mean?
Jana also says she doesn't like the assumption that she's any less of a Newfoundlander because of her skin tone. Newfoundlander does not equal Caucasian.
Even one teacher I had, she kind of singled out everyone and was like, oh yeah, you have good Newfie last names. And then it came to me. And then she's like, oh, where's that from? And I'm like, my dad's Indian. She's like, oh, and then just kind of like brushed it off. That really got under my skin. Yeah. Just because I'm not, quote unquote, the stereotypical Newfoundlander. Like, no, don't single me out because I don't have a Newfoundlander last name. Sorry.
Jana says she would prefer people ask questions rather than assume anything about her ethnicity, so long as it's done in a respectful manner.
Yeah, as long as you're respectful towards that person and their religion and their ethnicity and everything, like, there's ways around everything, but people always don't take the right ways.
But she also acknowledges she can't speak on behalf of everyone. Every case is different.
And, like, asking questions, obviously there's nothing wrong with it. The people are comfortable with it, but obviously not everybody's going to be as comfortable as me being like, oh yeah, this is what I am.
So the next time you think about asking that question, try and think about the person on the other end. For Kicker Radio, I'm Emily Leifer.
All right. Well, believe it or not, that was 89 minutes.
You're lying to me.
Of show. That's it. I swear. We want to say a big thank you to all of our guests that have come in today. Let's go through the list. Oh, we had Patty Daly. We had Ashley Fitzpatrick in the first hour. We had Catherine Anderson and Justin Campbell in the second hour, and then we just had
Bobby Lundgren and Haseen Khan. Sorry.
I got to tell you, when we do these segments, we think we're never going to have enough time or enough material, and then we always think we could probably go for 8 hours and just still keep talking. Yes. So, like I said, we want to encourage everybody to keep this conversation going. Please visit our website, www.kicker.cna-nl.com. Like we said, if there was ever a time to make a comment and be part of this dialogue, it's now for sure. Mm-hmm. To lead us out, we're going to hear one more song from CNA's own Kelly Loader. This is such a good tune. You can check out her video on YouTube, and the song is called Boxes. Thanks for listening.